Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today, broadcast and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. Today, what happens in the body when you think you're old? Also, how can we inhibit the growth of breast cancer? And remember, I've been saying that we are now raising a generation in the United States, but also in other countries, that will not outlive their parents. Our kids are going to die before we do. Why? Latest information on that. Also, fruit and vegetable compounds have a benefit if you have skin cancer. And I always like to give the latest from good science on something that's not really out there yet, but will be. And I'll tell you about something that can help you if you're diabetic. It comes from a tropical leaf extract. Then from our public health segment today, I have many things, like breeding mental illness in the U.S. And also talking about, from the New York Times today, Richard Friedman, a 700% increase in the number of psych drugs prescribed to active soldiers leads to more deaths by suicide than deaths by combat. How is that possible? I'll deal with that. How Big Pharma Gets You to Think a Drug is Safe, from Martha Rosenberg. From the environmental segment, there was a big oil spill recently in Arkansas. What, you didn't hear about it? Could that have anything in the world to do with the amount of money, millions of dollars, donated to the former Arkansas governor and attorney general Bill Clinton's foundation, or the enormous amount of money given to Hillary Clinton's presidential bid? We'll look at that. And then, vaccine legislation update. The vaccine police are knocking on your door. We'll tell you about that. My guest in the second part of our program today is Dr. Andrew Wakefield. And it turns out Dr. Wakefield was right. Dr. Gupta and Anderson Cooper and all the other people who attacked him were wrong. A new peer review article confirming what Andrew Wakefield did with the whole group and was pillared, lost his medical license because of that. He was right. Vindication today. Also today, commentary. I'm concerned about our educational system. I'm concerned that the campuses today are not coming forth with the type of activism that we need, and we do need it. Last evening on Bill O'Reilly, he was condemning a handful, just a mere handful of students protesting Karl Rove at one campus where they held up a banner and were marched out, and another speaker at another place was shouted at, and he thinks that's bad, and he's condemning any form of student activity that protests. Doesn't want to see any protest. Okay, I do. A commentary today. Dr. Professor Henry Giroux, Truth Out. Also, many of the listeners have asked, is it true that L-carnitine from meat can predispose you to heart disease? The New York Times says so, so it must be correct. No, it's not. A rebuttal, in-depth. Carnitine is not only not bad for you, carnitine reduces death rates. The difference is, I'll show you all of the science from peer-reviewed literature and then explain the theoretical basis of the argument that they were purporting. We have to do this, unfortunately, on a regular basis. Let's begin. There are times when I'm sure every person waking up looks in the mirror and think, oh, what happened overnight? How did I get this way? And then you go through a process of trying to psych yourself in, maybe going out running or biking, doing some yoga, where you want to feel better. But sometimes when you overwork or are stressed, you just feel old. There's a problem with that. And that is you can actually become what you think. So that's why I want people to always think young and vital and energetic and positive. And even when bad things happen, which they are inevitably going to do to all of us, look for the lesson that we can grow from that crisis, problem, catastrophe, whatever it may be. Here's the latest in the University of Exeter on this topic. Older adults who categorize themselves as old or frail encourage attitudinal and behavioral confirmation of that identity. That is the conclusion of a study conducted by a group of professors at the University of Exeter Medical School and presented to the British Psychological Society's annual conference. Now, what this means is this, in lay language. How many times have we told older people, take it easy? And hence, people begin to believe that they have to take it easy. Don't overdo it. And yet I have seen Paul Johnson, I've seen a man named Green, who are in their 80s. Try catching him on a track. You can't. They're that fast. They're lean, strong, and when you speak to them in competition afterwards, because when you go to a race, like a national championship race or World Games, and they've competed there, I've competed with them, you race in five-year increments. So when I'm racing, in, let's say, in the 45 to 49-year-old group, and they're racing in the 70 to 74-year-old group, we have a chance, since the older people always race first, we have a chance to watch them. And you ought to hear our comments about they're running like gazelles. Their whole mindset when you speak to them is, I'm not going to get old. I'm going to get stronger, faster. And indeed, their times and records show that. There's a man in New York who began his running with the Natural Living Running and Walking Club. Well, two, Sid Howard, who is considered the greatest master miler, senior miler in the world, and Sam Skinner. There's also several women, including Thelma Wilson, arguably the greatest woman senior athlete in the world, only challenged by Louise Nottage, who's won more senior Olympics than anyone else I'm aware of. Both started with us and raced for years and years and years with us. Their attitude, their lifestyle, their behavior, you would never know their age. Here's my philosophy. Never act your age. And yet we're encouraged to grow up and act our age. And I think that's a big mistake. And by the way, Sam Skinner just took first in his age group in the half marathon last weekend. That's a phenomenal feat. I don't know how old Sam is. I'm guessing he's 70 or 71. And Sam and I raced together many, many times. In fact, it was Sam who, along with Sid Howard and myself, the three of us competed in the 115 team championship for the best, fastest team in all of New York. That included the very big New York Roadrunners Club and the New York Athletic Club and these East Side Striders and all these others. It's a 10K race. Sam Skinner that day had a cold, and he was actually, when we were loosening up, he was wobbling. I say, Sam, forget it. We won't do the race. He said, no, I'm going to do it. I said, Sam, you know, you're not well enough. He said, no. Well, the gun went off and Sid went out like a bullet. And then I took the second lap of it, took the baton, and then Sam Skinner took the third, and we won best. And he came in, he was sweating. And he did it. He's a phenomenal athlete, one of the best in the world. But look how he eats. He's a vegan. Look at Sid Howard, a vegan, juicing, supplements, meditation, positive thinking, and would never act their ages. And by the way, I'm willing to bet if you saw Sam Skinner, you would not think he's a day over 38. And Sid Howard, 40. And I think Sid, 75. So while they are saying, if you act your age, if you think you're old, if you think you're weak, if you think you have no capacities and you're going to prove yourself right, and I'm saying we've got multiple examples, multiple, of people who will not let their chronological age limit the quality of their life and their capacity for performance. And just as an aside, one of America's great living artists just returned from my homestead, which is not even open yet, with his wife. I believe he's 87, and he was going down to do some sculpting work. Came out of the clear blue, and they took a photograph and sent it to me. And this man's in, you know, he's lifting stuff, and he has the physique of a 30-year-old. I believe he's 87. But he's not 87 in his mind. And that's where it begins. Next up, for those of you who want to help understand the growth of triple-negative breast cancer and inhibiting it, there's new good information from mainstream medical news today. And here's what it says. Researchers from Fox Chase Cancer Center have found that the omega-3 fatty acids and their metabolite products slow or stop the proliferation or growth in the number of cells of triple-negative breast cancer cells more effectively than cells from a luminal types of the disease. The omega-3 fatty acids, quote, work against all type of cancerous cells. But the effect was observed to be stronger in triple-negative cell lines by as much as reducing the proliferation by 90%. And this was presented at the AACR annual meeting. So there you have it. One way that we can help women protect their breasts. Now, mind you, the omega-3 fatty acids come from vegan sources like walnuts and flaxseed oil, but they also in avocados and also then from fish. I'm looking at the oldest lived cultures in the world for a new article I'm writing. And I'm finding that people on the island of Crete have the longest lifespan as a group. Before it was in Okinawa, and they're of Japanese descent. And then Japan is a large nation that has the oldest living population in the world. But that's changing, and it's changing very rapidly because the younger generation are drinking colas and high fructose corn syrup and hamburgers and hot dogs. They're completely eliminating the traditional Japanese diet of fermented foods, organic soy-based diet, fish, vegetables, sea vegetables, seaweeds, slow eating, family eating. All this is going by the wayside. And as a result, they're really coming down in their life expectancy. In the United States, it's the worst of all because kids are not exercising. They're going to get brain cancer in epidemic numbers or jaw cancer because of cell phones. They're overstimulated with caffeine and other food additives and sugars. They're not getting sleep. Their immune systems are shot. They're not taking supplements. They're not eating fruits and vegetables. They're living off highly processed foods. Here's the latest, and this is rather revealing. Quote, old before their time, now aging quicker than their parents. This is from The Independent. Poor diet and lack of exercise blamed for increase in obesity, blood pressure, and diabetes. We are living longer yet growing less healthy. That is the paradoxical conclusion reached by researchers who have found successive generations building up medical problems worse than those faced by their forebears. Life expectancy has grown dramatically in recent decades as a result of improved nutrition, housing, and medical care. But today's 40-year-olds are experiencing problems of excess weight, high blood pressure, and diabetes, similar to those now found in much older. The younger generation is thus 15 years ahead of the older generation on the pathway to increasing frailty, disability, and ill health. Ultimately, the effect is likely to be slowing the increase in life expectancy or even reversal. So, it catches up. So now if you're 40, what this is saying is if you're 40 chronologically, you're probably about 60 biologically. And finally, good news for those of you who are consuming your fruits and vegetables, and I know a lot of you are, this is the latest on DNA and fruits and vegetables. Quote, a naturally occurring compound in fruits and vegetables may be effective against skin cancers. The data suggested gossypentin, a naturally occurring compound in fruits and vegetables, may be useful in the battle against melanoma thanks to its ability to block DNA mutations. We identified gossypin, G-O-S-S-Y-P-I-N, is a novel agent with dual inhibitory activity towards two common mutations that are the ideal targets for melanoma treatment. And this was done at the Texas Biomedical Research Institute. Our research indicate that gossypin may have great therapeutic potential in blocking or inhibiting mutations. So, one more reason to eat your fruits and vegetables every day. The more you eat, the more anti-cancer protection you have. And there is an extract. It's a tropical leaf extract. It's called Elaeus guineensis or ficus deltoia. And it can benefit the health of people with prediabetes by improving blood sugar and lipid levels in this clinical trial. So, that's all good. And the common name that you can find it at is African palm oil. That's one. And so, more on that as it comes up. I just like to give you a little heads up that good stuff is happening and we'll give you the latest on it. Now, I wish to respond to the New York Times. Normally, on many areas, they do outstanding reporting. On some, when it comes to health or challenging the existing medical community and its institutions or its leaders, it does not do well. More often than not, it allows itself to be nothing more than a propaganda arm of the big pharmaceutical industry. A Koth 2003 response, 2013 response, quote, intestinal microbiota metabolism of L-carnitine, a nutrient in red meat, promotes atherosclerosis, end quote. That's the headline. So now they're associating the L-carnitine specifically on impacting the microorganisms in the intestine for causing atherosclerosis. So therefore, anyone using L-carnitine in their therapeutic regimens are fearing that they will end up with atherosclerosis. Let us deconstruct this for this audience. The heart muscle uses fat as its primary energy source. Carnitine is a fat-transporting compound that is absolutely essential for normal heart function. Now, over time, the decline of carnitine plays a role in the weakening of the heart's muscles. People with heart muscle damage from heart attacks or heart failure have especially low levels of carnitine. Fortunately, carnitine supplementation has proven to be remarkably effective in fighting and even reversing the heart weakening effects from that drop in carnitine levels. In one study, 160 male and female heart attack survivors between 39 and 86 years of age received 4 grams, that's 4,000 milligrams a day, of L-carnitine or a placebo for 12 months. The patients taking L-carnitine experienced significantly favorable decreases in heart rate and blood pressure. They also improved their blood lipid profiles. Most importantly, those supplementing with carnitine had a dramatically reduced death rate compared to those not taking carnitine. patients taking carnitine had a death rate of 1.2% in the entire year, while 12.5% of control patients died, with a majority of those deaths attributed to repeat heart attacks. L-carnitine supplementation also prevents the progression of heart muscle damage in people with congestive heart failure and improves exercise tolerance in people who develop chest pain, angina with exertion. In one study, 55% of patients experience improvement in their standard heart failure classification. People with angina, an early sign of heart muscle threatened by ischemia, which is low blood flow, benefited from carnosine supplementation. A natural derivative of L-carnitine, which is a propranolol carnitine at a dose of 500 milligrams 3 times a day, increased the mean time that patients could exercise without EKG signs of ischemia by an increase of 450%. That result indicated improved blood flow to heart muscle cells following ischemia, an effect amply demonstrated in animal studies. Carnitine also increases concentrations of nitric oxide that help endothelial cells relax and increase blood flow, which can help lower blood pressure. 3 weeks of supplementing with 2 grams of L-carnitine improved blood flow by 17% during the critical after-meal period in a group of people fed a high-fat meal. Placebo patients had a 12% decrease in blood flow, and a daily 6-gram intravenous dose of the carnitine for 1 week improved walking distance in people with peripheral artery disease by 20%. An obesity rate is skyrocketing. More and more Americans are developing type 2 diabetes as a result, producing a syndrome called diabesity. Now, since carnitine helps the mitochondria utilize energy, it plays a critical role in reducing the occurrence and impact of diabesity. And recent disease studies show that in addition to helping the mitochondria burn fat as energy, carnitine is also vital for removing waste products from mitochondria. Now, this is important because we now recognize that the buildup of mitochondrial waste products is one of the most important contributors to insulin resistance, which further promotes high blood sugar and obesity. And obesity and aging contribute to low carnitine levels, which compromises mitochondrial performance and increases insulin resistance, promoting further obesity and carnitine reduction. So restoring carnitine levels to their youthful values is an effective way to break this deadly cycle. Now, oxygen-deprived endothelial cells produce large amounts of free radicals, and laboratories suggesting the findings that carnitine protects these cells during periods of oxygen deprivation. When blood flow is restored, carnitine also shows that it helps the cells to regain their lost energy charge much faster. An animal study indicates that carnitine prevents abnormal heart muscle function associated with diabetes. In a 2013 study published in Nature Magazine, or Medicine, researchers studied the effects of gut bacteria and associated metabolism of compounds in vegetarians and omnivores, specifically red meat consumption. Of note, the study authors identify an association between the TMAO, the trimethylaminooxide, an oxidation product of trimethylaminooxidation, and a compound found in relatively large amount in shellfish, crustaceans, and deep ocean fish, and mollusks, and gut microbacteria, and the metabolism of L-carnitine. The researchers provocatively concluded that the TMAO, as a gut bacterial metabolic byproduct of L-carnitine metabolism in people who eat red meat, potentially represents a novel cause of atherosclerosis. Let us deconstruct this. 1. Limited research on TMO and associated effects on human health prevent causal interpretation at this time. Bolin's search of the peer-reviewed literature using terms TMAO and atherosclerosis yields very little information, only 3 results on this topic, with the first suggestion of a potential association in 2011. correlation is not causation. And in fact, TMAO is found in relatively large quantities in fish, a food that is linked to a markedly reduced risk of cardiovascular events. I found over 163 articles on the omega-3 fatty acids in fish lowering the incidence of heart disease. In contrast, components of red meat, such as saturated fat, raises LDL cholesterol, and a Boleyn search of the peer-reviewed literature using terms such as LDL, cholesterol, and atherosclerosis returns over 10,500 results. 2. Published peer-reviewed research demonstrates how carnitine prevents the progression of atherosclerosis and lesions that are in the atherosclerotic person. Now, this study focused upon the metabolic conversion of L-carnitine to TMAO by gut bacteria and the differences in the gut metabolism between red meat eaters and vegetarians. In fact, many studies show that L-carnitine has a variety of beneficial effects on cardiovascular function, including prevention of progression of atherosclerotic lesions. For example, one study reported that in the context of a hypercholesterolemia, L-carnitine supplementation, quote, completely prevented the progression of atherosclerotic lesions induced by hypercholesterolemia in both aorta and coronaries, end quote. In another study, supplementation of L-carnitine used as a drug in Europe for treatment of atherosclerosis, quote, induced a marked lowering of plasma triglycerides, very low-density lipoproteins, and intermediate density lipoproteins and triglycerides, end quote. And while plasma cholesterol was slightly and transiently reduced, in addition, the L-carnitine, quote, exhibited a reduction of plaque thickness and extent and a reduction of the number of both proliferating macrophages and smooth muscle cell-derived foam cells. By the way, foam cells are precursors to atherosclerotic lesions. And finally, published peer-review evidence shows L-carnitine effectively treats peripheral artery disease caused by atherosclerosis. Intermittent claudication, you know, the painful calves, atherosclerotic syndrome that is known to be because of peripheral artery disease. In a 2013 systematic review of 40 different articles on intermittent claudication found that L-carnitine demonstrated a benefit in functional performance with L-carnitine supplementation. The authors suggest routine supplementation with carnitine, quote, may therefore be a useful adjunct therapy for management of intermittent claudication. And what we have to understand is that in the individuals that were vegetarian, none of the negative consequences was shown. So my suggestion is this, that before the American media allow itself to scare Americans from using a positive therapeutic tool that is natural, like L-carnitine, that they pull back and do their own independent research and review the actual scientific literature, and then decide if what they are about to write is honest, fair, and the best that we have currently. Also, I currently have 421 articles in the peer-reviewed journals showing that the vegetarian and specifically vegan diet substantially increases your lifespan, substantially and statistically significantly in reduce the incidence of cancers, heart disease, blood pressure, diabetes. Why wouldn't the New York Times then promote a vegan healthy diet? And that is that comment. In a moment, I'll be going to my guest, but I do have one commentary, and then we'll talk about the latest on the safety and efficacy of vaccines with Dr. Andrew Wakefield. Please stay with us.
Say it's alright.
It's alright.
It's alright. Have a good time, 'cause it's
I'd like to welcome all of you from all over the world. We are listened to on land-based terrestrial stations, our sister stations, New York, WBAI, in Washington, D.C., WPFW, in Los Angeles for 30 years. 30 years in Washington and Los Angeles on KPFK, 35 years, 36 years now on WBAI in New York. And here is the issue. I'm concerned, as is Professor Henry Giroux, that our educational system is not allowing the type of challenge to establish thought and some of the traditional values that we have accepted without any in-depth perception adjustment. We need to change that. There's an urgent necessity on the part of the American public to reclaim the educational system. We have abrogated. We have allowed corporate interest and ideologues to usurp much of the educational system. The current assault on higher education by the apostles of neoliberalism and religious fundamentalists make it clear that it should not be harnessed to cost-benefit analysis or this singular needs of corporations, which often leads to the loss of egalitarian and democratic pressures. Universities should be about more than developing work skills. They must also be about producing civic-minded and critically engaged citizens, citizens who can engage in debate and dialogue and bear witness to a different and critical sense of remembering, remembering ethics, remembering collective resistance. The very notion of what Villarelli challenged and dismissed and regaled against, throwing us back to the 1960s as if the outpouring on college campuses was something that was wrong. No, Bill, it was right. We must also be about producing civic-minded and critically engaged citizens. Citizens who can engage in debate, and citizens who are not afraid. If not, then what? Universities are some of the few places left where a struggle for the commons, for public life, if not democracy itself, can be made visible through the medium of collective voices and social movements energized by the need for a politics and a way of life counter to authoritarian capitalism. We are living in a time in which democratic institutions and public spheres are being downsized, if not altogether disappearing. As these institutions vanish and from public schools to healthcare centers, there's also a serious erosion of the discourses of community, justice, equality, public values, and the common good. We increasingly live in societies based on the vocabulary of choice and a denial of reality, a denial of massive inequality. We deny social disparities. We deny the irresponsible concentration of power in collective few hands and a growing machinery of social and civil death. More and more individuals and groups are becoming imaginary, others defined by a free-floating capitalist class that inscribes them as disposable, redundant, irrelevant. Where do you fit? Where do I fit? The American public increasingly exhibits zones of hardship and suffering and terminal exclusion. This is all the more reason for scholars, for students, for teachers to address the important social issues and for the university to defend itself as a democratic public space. We live in a world in which everything is now privatized, transformed into spaces of consumption, and subject to the vicissitudes of the national security state. One consequence is the emergence of what the late Tony Jolt called the eviscerated society, one that is stripped of the thick mesh of mutual obligations and social responsibilities to be found in any viable democracy. Now, this grim reality has been called a failed societal place, a failure of the power of the civic imagination, a failure of political will, and a failure of open democracy. as the welfare state continues to be attacked and the punishing state increasingly criminalizes social issues, extending from homelessness, and every single form of peaceful protest is now considered a terrorist act by someone in power. Even your dress code can result in a violation in public schools. And academics and other cultural workers should not, under the guise of professionalism, remove themselves from ethical considerations and the power relations that impact them in the world. When was the last time you and I saw a large group of academics, a large group of scholars, a large group of tenured professors marching in unison against the crimes of our society? The wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, the wars against our bodies, the wars of indoctrination of our youth on television ads, that they should eat and drink what they're shown, in spite of the fact that everyone knows, and the literature is replete with evidence, it causes disease, obesity, diabetes. And where are the words that they could speak so elegantly, so powerfully in protest? Muted to a single classroom, to an occasional article, or none at all? Where are they in standing up and giving a voice to the 18 million voiceless children who go to bed hungry each day in the United States, to the 54 million Americans who've been removed from their homes by their very banks, when Chris Hedges and myself and others held arms and around Bank America in protest? Where were the academics? Where were the students? Where were those with their MBAs? Rushing off to get one of the jobs of Wall Street? The university likewise should not collude with the ongoing assaults against social provisions that are waged by policymakers who view marginalized populations as disposable, as waste products of a society that would rather warehouse its citizens, particularly poor minorities, in dilapidated schools and prisons than provide them with decent social protections and health care and jobs, a quality education and a future that matters. Hence, one goal of those concerned about creating engaged citizens capable of struggling for racial equality and radical democracy is to develop new practices and modes of civic literacy that connect rigorous scholarship to important social issues, such as the war being waged on youth today and the increasing militarization of all aspects of society, the attack upon the state and our rights. And let us not forget the escalating destruction of the environment. In conclusion, there is no way that we can turn our backs on this. There's a need to reclaim those vibrant ideologies, legacies, and struggles that served and continue to serve as a reminder of how important the liberal arts are, not just as specific fields of study, but also as a broader civic education force that enables the development of a formative culture necessary for all students to enliven the imagination, think critically, recognize the ethical grammar of suffering, and connect public values to collective struggles that expand and deepen the process of democracy. Informing such a project would be an attempt to develop a language of critique and possibility, one that recognizes that education is, in part, a moral and political practice whose mission, as the poet Robert Haas points out, is to refresh the idea of justice going dead in us all the time. We find ourselves at an important historical moment in which there is a need to reclaim the most robust and democratic versions of the discourse of freedom, justice, collective struggle in history. Americans occupy a historical conjuncture in which everything that matters politically, ethically, and culturally is being erased, ignored, or turned into a commodity, or simply falsified. Occasionally, we are confronted with the unsullied images, history, and legacy of intellectuals and those who think critically, who symbolize that rare combination of civic courage, political commitment, and rigorous scholarship. Professor Henry Giroux. Let's go to my guest who's standing by. Andrew Wakefield is a gastroenterologist. He is an academic specializing in inflammatory bowel disease and the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, or MMR. He is a former fellow of the Royal College of Surgeons and has published over 130 original peer-reviewed scientific papers and book chapters. In 1998, he and his colleagues at the Royal Free Hospital in London reported a novel inflammatory bowel disease in children with developmental disorders such as autism. Dr. Wakefield resisted pressure to stop his investigations into a possible link between vaccinations, intestinal inflammation, and autism. In 2001, he was awarded the fellowship of the Royal College of Pathologists, and he's been a board member of the American charity Medical Interventions for Autism. He is also the author of Callous Disregard, Autism and Vaccines, The Truth Behind the Tragedy, from Skyhorse Press. Nice to have you back with us.
Gary, it's a great pleasure to be with you again.
I want to read something that I just received this morning from Alliance of Natural Health. Quote, was Andrew Wakefield right all along? Science doesn't exist in a vacuum. If a piece of research into an active area of scientific inquiry is valid, sooner or later it will be repeated or otherwise confirmed by other researchers. To listen to any of Andrew Wakefield's many detractors, one would think that no scientific evidence has emerged since 1998 in support of his supposedly fraudulent case series retracted by The Lancet in 2010, but that's simply not true. As has now been pointed out, not least by Wakefield himself in his second book, Waging War on the Autistic Child, this week in the peer-reviewed journal PLOS ONE, published data that powerfully confirm Wakefield and his associates' original results. And then it goes on to the high level of scientific inquiry that found just about identically the gene expression profiles and samples that you found. And so on one hand, I'm probably imagining that you feel vindicated at some level by the good quality independent science showing that you and your colleagues were right.
Yes, Gary, I think firstly from the position of the other side, they have focused exclusively on that 1998 paper, a case series of 12 children, which was really the beginning of our work in this area. And in order to give credence to their position, they have given the impression that that is the only paper that was ever published on this and that no one else has been able to replicate it. Now, in contrast, by the time I'd left the Royal Free, we'd published 15 or 16 papers on the bowel disease, taking it to new levels of discovery and description and comparing it with controls. No one ever mentions those papers. And then there have been five or six independent groups from around the world who've also reported the same bowel disease. And now we have this paper in PLOS ONE, which takes it to an entirely new level, where Dr. Krigsman and Dr. Steve Walker, the latter from Wake Forest University Medical School, have characterized in great detail the what they've called the molecular signatures, what's actually happening at the molecular level in this disease, and showing two things in essence. One is that there is undoubtedly, there are pathological changes in the intestine of children with autism that distinguish their biopsies from normal controls, healthy controls who don't have autism or bowel inflammation. And the second thing is that that pattern of molecular signature, although it has some overlap with classical inflammatory bowel disease like Crohn's and ulcerative colitis, also has clear distinctions. And so the question that it raises, and one that really reiterates our feelings all those years ago, is that there may be a novel form of inflammatory bowel disease in children with autism, or perhaps a precursor, a forerunner of something like Crohn's disease. In other words, a sort of disease in evolution at the early stage of a disease like Crohn's. Now, we don't know at this stage, but a very, very important paper.
The issue for this audience is this. Are the vaccines that we are being mandated to take, and now there's a big push in states all across the United States where you're going to be required, you'll have no choice. For example, the flu vaccine in six states, it'll be required by all health workers in Connecticut, Illinois, Missouri. It'll be required by the elderly. The HP, the human papillomavirus, is now being required in 6 states. Required for boys and girls in Kentucky and New York, Virginia. The meningitis vaccine, routinely used in middle schools in many states. The DPT vaccine. And so what's happening is behind all this is a group, a very powerful group called ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Group, representing about 300-plus major multinational corporations, and they meet twice a year with our state legislators, all in secret. They've been doing this for 40 years. They give them bills, and these bills have to benefit the manufacturers. Well, there's nothing as profitable as a vaccine, and it's extremely profitable. So the state legislators come back and say, we want to make this a law, and they make it a law, and now you have to get a vaccine. No one's asking this basic question. Are vaccines safe? Where's your proof from independent research? Are they effective? And effective means don't just show me that you created an antibody. Prove to me that that antibody is protective for a specific condition, and then tell me how long it's protective. Because I just finished a major documentary. It'll be out in about a month and a half, where 47 leading immunologists and vaccinologists stated on the record that there's not a single piece of proof they can find that is independent of quality that any of these vaccines are safe or effective as given, and that the MMR vaccine that you were testing, and or not testing, but you were examining the consequence of, is extremely dangerous. Your thoughts, please.
Yes, my position back in 1997-98 really started with the parent story. You know, this is what happened to my child, and that is where medicine really must begin, and indeed medical science must begin. What happened to the patient? What is their narrative? And the story that we heard then was regression following the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine. But as you well know, Gary, the more you look into this, the more complex it becomes. And then it emerged, and I didn't know this at the time, it emerged that the preservative, the mercury preservative thimerosal was in there. That should clearly never have been in there. And that will merely add to compound the risk of a live viral vaccine because it's a poison to the immune system and to the brain and to cells in general. And then much more recently, there has been major concern, justifiable concern, about the use of aluminum, a major human poison, in these vaccines as an adjuvant to boost the immune response. Indeed, many of the vaccines probably wouldn't even work at all if they didn't have this immune system poison in there. So you have a whole host of agents in the vaccines, and that's just a very short list that really shouldn't be there and are potentially very toxic to human beings. So the potential for an interaction between these elements is very, very real, and has never been subjected to anything like the kind of rigorous science that it should be prior to going into children. And you mentioned the HPV vaccine. I'm just reading on my computer at the moment from a notice from Judicial Watch that Department of Health and Human Services have compensated 49 victims of the vaccine out of the 200 claims that have been filed so far to the tune of approximately $6 million. It really, really confirms that the concerns about this vaccine from the outset were very well founded. And this was a vaccine that was really intended initially for developing countries that didn't have access to routine cervical smears, which are the most effective way of detecting and preventing cervical cancer. It was not intended for first world countries like the US, but there was a clear market there. And so this is a marketing exercise. And there is no evidence of efficacy. There's no evidence that it's protected anyone against cervical cancer. And there is no evidence, and nor will there ever be any evidence, that it is better than routine cervical smears for this condition. So it is a disgrace that we are now, children are mandated to have this vaccine in many states, both girls and boys, when there is no evidence that it is safe. And what is even more alarming is I understand that a bill was passed in California which would allow children independently of their parents, in other words, potentially against their parental wishes, to go ahead and decide to have this vaccine for themselves. Now, I can imagine a situation, Gary, where a child goes to school and they are shown a video, and a video may even be produced by the pharmaceutical company, and that video shows the alarming consequences of some cases of cervical cancer, for example. Horrendous pictures are shown to them, and then they're offered an iPad if they have their full complement of vaccines. And they go home, and in defiance of their parents' wishes, that child is coerced or frightened into having the vaccine. I can see that kind of situation arising because this is all about a marketing exercise. That bill on its own really destroys or seeks to destroy the fabric of the American family, where parents made decisions about their children's health on behalf of their children because they are morally, legally, and biologically responsible for those children.
But in the United States, Dr. Wakefield, every single person is a commodity. We serve no other useful function in a society except as how someone can profit from us. That's the unfortunate part. And children are just the latest examples of that. My final statement I'd like for you to make is one of the most respected gastroenterologists and academics in your country was with you, and he also lost his medical license, but he fought back, and he was completely cleared of all charges. He was made 100% whole. And are you following the same path as him?
Yes, I'd very much like to, and I did. We both appealed the GMC's appalling decision, travesty, and that went to the High Court for Professor Walker Smith. I was presented, his appeal was funded by the his insurance company. Mine was not, and therefore I could not appeal. I was faced with a situation of having to put up some £500,000, $700,000. I couldn't do that, so I had to withdraw my appeal. Professor Walker Smith went ahead and won comprehensively. The judge in that appeal lamented the appalling behavior of the General Medical Council's panel, in effect leading to the conclusion that they were incompetent and perhaps even worse, biased. And 90% of the charges against Professor Walker Smith were the same as those against me. And so clearly, there is tacit exoneration for me in respect of those charges as well. However, my name will not be cleared by the General Medical Council because there is no mechanism in British civil law for reopening an appeal once it has been withdrawn. But that's just, I'm afraid, a fact of life, and there are more important things to worry about than me getting my medical license.
Well, what is important today is you've been found by this latest research in PLOS One. That they showed that what you did was correct, and that's what's important for us. Thank you very much, Dr. Wakefield, for being on today.
It's a pleasure, Gary. Thank you very much.
Now it's time for Talk Back, your opportunity to call in and share your comments, thoughts, and points of view. Our number is 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. And for those of you who, especially out in California, because there's a three-hour difference between New York and California, a lot of people are going to work or are out driving, you can always listen, put it on the speaker, and listen over the telephone. And this is the number one listened to program out of 4,000 different companies or servers. And we have millions and millions and millions of minutes. People listen. Call 619-550-0869, 619-550-0869. You can listen to this program anytime over the telephone. Let's say hello to Luann Panessi, who's standing by. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. I've got a number of your audience members sending me an email that had come up somewhere on the Internet about the American Civil Liberties Union filed a Freedom of Information Act requesting to find out whether the IRS is reading your emails without a warrant. The IRS claims that it has the right to go into your account and read them. And, of course, everyone is up in arms about this. When it comes to getting a warrant to read your email, the relevant law is the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, which was enacted way back in 1986. So, according to that law, the government can read your email without a warrant as long as the email has been opened or if it's been sitting in your inbox for more than 180 days. Only unopened email that's been on the server for less than 180 days requires a warrant. So it's this kind of arbitrary distinction, and it kind of sets us up here. So, of course, they're asking, what does Gary have to say about this, and what can we do about this?
I believe that we should have a flat tax. It is the only responsible way of dealing with tax avoidance by corporations. If you just look at it this way. If you're a big corporation, even a medium-sized corporation, you're going to hire CPAs and tax experts that are going to get you out of paying your fair share of taxes. As a result, people who keep their money in Wall Street accounts and hedge funds and other, they don't pay any taxes till they actually spend that money. I believe they should pay taxes when they earn that money. So I believe that we have to reform the following. A, you have one flat income tax, federal corporate tax. That way, every corporation has to pay it with no deductions. That means you eliminate the IRS completely. You eliminate all the audits and all the nonsense and the harassment that has historically been a part of them, including reading your illegally and unethically reading your emails. Secondly, you would get at least $1 trillion in additional tax revenues coming in. Then you give a forgiveness fee for all outstanding offshore accounts, which are about $32 trillion that we know of, and at 15% still gives them 85%, they'd be happy with that. Then they can use that money in the United States. And that, along with getting tax money that otherwise is avoided, legally avoided, would help within a period of 3 years to balance the budget, would wipe out $15, $16 trillion. And then, on every trade on Wall Street, put a 5% tax. No matter what you do with the money, you have to pay it. If you have to pay 5% of every single trade, including the trades that are algorithm, which about 70% of all the trades, that would bring in about $1.2 trillion a year. So that's what we should be doing if we really cared about getting income in and having a fair tax system. Thanks a lot for your call. Let's say hello to Jerry from Staten Island. Hi, Jerry.
Hey, hi, Mr. Mills. I just want to know, we're losing all our rights, and how come there is no protest? How come there is nothing organized? Why is people still just going about life like everything is okay? Maybe me and my friends are the only ones that see what's going on.
No, there are a lot of people who know what's going on. If you were to look at the constitutional groups out there, the liberty groups out there, the groups that are historically marginalized by the left and the right because they're really looking at the truth, and that scares the hell out of the corporatists, then they're given no credibility. But there are an awful lot of people who are caring about our society, and you protest, for example, in different ways. You protest when you take your money out of their banks. You protest when you don't go to their Walmarts. You protest when you don't buy their slave labor products or their genetically engineered foods. You protest when you don't vote for their politicians, when you vote for Gary Johnson or Ralph Nader or Jill Stein or Rocky Anderson. That's when it makes a difference. Then you have to start joining together on issues like genetic engineering, and you do it at the grassroots level. And right now, in almost 39 states, we have grassroots level initiatives to get referendums on the ballots to vote for the labeling of GMOs. And they then come in and threaten states. Monsanto and others threaten the states that they'll sue them. Well, let them sue them. They'll lose those lawsuits. They lie about everything. But you have to protest, and you protest by signing those petitions and by going out to when there is a demonstration. We have to inconvenience ourselves to do so. But when we inconvenience ourselves and we say, I will not buy something that is not made in the USA or grown in the USA or grown locally or supporting, you know, a sustainable part of my life, then you're protesting in a very conscientious way. And then look at the different causes that are out there, like closing down nuclear power plants or stopping gas hydrofracking or vaccines. You get a mother and a father whose kid has been injured with a vaccine, watch how much of an activist they become. But unfortunately, that represents about all told maybe 10% of the American population. That's still 30 million people. But it means that 90% choose not to be informed. You, Jerry, and your friends choose to be informed. It's a choice. You also know that when you choose to be informed and you open the door, you don't know what's going to face you. If you're afraid of that truth and afraid of what it means, the fact that we have supported things we should not have, eaten things, drank things that we should not have, then you also have to have the capacity of forgiving yourself and then getting straight with going forward on a project. Most people are not willing to do that. They're stuck in their comfort zones. They're stuck in the denial, the essence of life. They're not living an authentic life. They're caught in this almost a euphoria where drugs, tranquilizers, alcohol misshape their perceptions, change their reality. And so they're just getting sicker, compliant, and obedient. If people came knocking on their door tomorrow, dressed in SWAT uniforms, saying, stick out your arm, we're going to give you 23 vaccinations, you wouldn't have 5% say what's in them, and do I have a right to say no? That's how compliant we are. We are a police state. We're living in fascist times. And it won't be until there is a major catastrophe that we appreciate how much we have gone from the point of being a true democracy. Thanks a lot for your calls. We're out of time. I thank you all for listening. Now let's say hello to Utrice Lead. Hi, Utrice.
Hello, Gary. Today, three separate but related stories illustrating the quest for economic, political, and judicial justice.
Great. We look forward to it. Utrice Lead, right now.
I remember my first love affair. Somehow or another, the whole darn thing went wrong. And my mama had some great advice, so I thought I'd put it in the words of this song. I can still hear her saying, boy,
boy, boy,
boy, I see you sitting out there all alone, crying your eyes out, cause the woman that you love.